nothing to do with the treatment as I think of my real bed, my parents, Abby. I pick up my phone to see a text from my dad. It's a picture of his old acoustic guitar leaning against a worn nightstand in his new apartment. He spent the whole day setting it up after I insisted he do that instead of take me to the hospital. He pretended not to be relieved, just like I pretended Mom was taking me so he wouldn't feel guilty. It's been a lot of pretending since the most ridiculous divorce of all time. It's been 6 months, and they still can't even look at each other. For some reason, it makes me want to hear his voice so badly. I tap on his contact info and almost press the green call button on my phone, but decide not to at the last second. I never call the first day, and all the coughing that the Aflo vest makes me do would make him nervous. He's still texting me every hour to check in. I don't want to worry my parents. I can't. Better to just wait until morning. My eyes shoot open the next morning, and I look for what woke me, seeing my phone vibrating noisily on the floor, having free-fallen off the table. I squint at the drained milkshake glasses and mound of empty chocolate pudding cups taking up practically the entire space. No wonder the phone fell off. If we're 60% water, I'm closing in on the remaining 40% being pudding. I groan, reaching over the bed to grab my phone, my G-tube burning with a stretch. I gently touch my side, lifting my shirt to unhook the tube, surprised that the skin around it is even redder and more inflamed than it was before. That's not good. Irritations usually go away with a little bit of Fusidin, but my application yesterday didn't seem to make a difference. I put a bigger glob of the ointment on it, hoping that will clear it up, and add a note to my to-do list to monitor it before scrolling through my notifications. I have a couple of snaps waiting from Maya and Camila, looking sleepy but happy as they boarded the plane this morning. Both of my parents texted me, checking in to see how I slept, if I'm settled in, and saying to give them a call when I get up. I'm about to answer the both of them when my phone vibrates and I swipe right to see a text from Poe. You up? I shoot back a quick message, seeing if he wants to have our usual breakfast date in 20, before putting the phone down and swinging my legs over my bed to grab my laptop. Less than a second later, my phone buzzes with his reply. Yes! I grin, hitting the nurse call button by my bed. Julie's friendly voice crackles through the speaker. Morning, Stella! You good? Yep. Can I get breakfast now? I ask, turning my laptop on. You got it! The time on my laptop reads 9 a.m., and I pull the med cart closer, looking at the color-coded clumps I laid out yesterday. I smile to myself, realizing that this time tomorrow, after I get the beta version of my app fully up and running, I'll be getting a notification on my phone telling me to take my morning pills and the exact dosages of each that I need. Almost a year of hard work finally coming together. An app for all chronic illnesses, complete with med charts, schedules, and dosage information. I take my pills and open Skype, scanning the contact list to see if either of my parents is on. There's a tiny green dot next to my dad's name, and I press the call button, waiting as it rings noisily. His face appears on the screen as he puts his thick-rimmed glasses over his tired eyes. I notice that he's still in his pajamas, his graying hair jutting out in every direction, a lumpy pillow propped up behind him. Dad was always an early riser. Out of bed before 7:30 every morning, even on the weekends. The worry starts to slowly wrap itself tighter around my insides. You need a shave, I say, taking in the unusual stubble covering his chin. He's always been clean-shaven, except for a beard phase he went through one winter during elementary school. He chuckles, rubbing his scruffy chin.
You need new lungs. Mic drop.
I roll my eyes as he laughs at his own joke. How is the gig? He shrugs.
You know.
I'm glad you're performing again, I say cheerily, trying my best to look positive for him.
Sore throat doing okay?
He asks, giving me a worried look. I nod, swallowing to confirm that the rawness in my throat has started to subside. Already a million times better. Relief fills his eyes, and I change the subject quickly before he can ask any more treatment-related questions. How's your new apartment? He gives me an over-the-top smile.
It's great. It's got a bed and a bathroom.
His smile fades slightly, and he shrugs.
And not much else. I'm sure your mom's place is nicer. She could always make anywhere feel like home.
Maybe if you just call her. He shakes his head at me and cuts me off.
Moving on. Seriously. It's fine, hon. The place is great, and I've got you and my guitar. What else do I need?
My stomach clenches, but there's a knock on my door and Julie comes in, holding a dark green tray with a pile of food. My dad sees her and brightens up.
Julie, how have you been?
Julie puts down the tray and presents her belly to him. For someone who insisted for the past 5 years that she was never having children, she seems ridiculously eager to be having children.
Very busy, I see,
my dad says, smiling wide. Talk to you later, Dad, I say, moving my cursor over to the end call button. Love you. He gives me a salute before the chat ends. The smell of eggs and bacon wafts off the plate, a giant chocolate milkshake sitting on the tray next to it. Need anything else, Del? Some company? I glance at her baby bump, shaking my head as a surprising swell of contempt fills my chest. I love Julie, but I'm really not in the mood for talking about her new little family when mine's falling apart. Poe's about to call me. Right on time, my laptop pings, and Poe's picture pops up, the green phone symbol appearing on my screen. Julie rubs her stomach, giving me a strange look before flashing me a tight-lipped, confused smile. Okay, you two have fun. I press accept, and Poe's face slowly comes into view, his thick black eyebrows hanging over familiar, warm brown eyes. He's gotten a haircut since the last time I saw him. Shorter. Cleaner. He gives me a big ear-to-ear smile, and I attempt to grin back, but it ends up looking more like a grimace. I can't get the image of my dad out of my head. So sad and alone, in bed, but the lines of his face still deep and filled with exhaustion. And I can't even go check on him.
Hey, Mommy, you are looking worn,
he says, putting his milkshake down and squinting at me.
You go on one of your chocolate pudding benders again?
I know this is where I'm supposed to laugh, but I seem to have used up my pretending quota for the day, and it's not even 9:30 yet. Poe frowns.
Uh-oh, what's wrong? Is it Cabo? You know sunburn is nothing to play with anyway.
I wave that away and instead hold up my tray like a game show model to show Poe my lumberjack breakfast. Eggs, bacon, potatoes, and a milkshake. The usual for our breakfast dates. Poe gives me a challenging look, like I'm not getting away with that subject change, but he can't resist holding up his plate to show me the identical meal, except his eggs are beautifully embellished with chives, parsley, and... wait. Freaking truffles. Poe, where the hell did you get truffles? He raises his eyebrows, smirking.
You gotta bring him with, mija, he says as he moves the webcam to show me a med cart that he's converted into a perfectly organized spice rack. It's filled with jars and specialty items instead of pill bottles, sitting under his shrine to his favorite skateboarder, Paul Rodriguez, and the entire Colombian national soccer team. Classic Poe. Food, skateboarding, and football are by far his three favorite things. He has enough jerseys pinned up on his wall to fully clothe every CFer on this floor for a poor-playing, no-cardiovascular-strength B team. The camera swings back to him, and I see Gordon Ramsay's chest peering out from behind him. But first, our appetizers. He holds up a handful of Creon tablets, which will help our bodies digest the food we're about to eat. Best part of every meal, I say sarcastically as I scoop my red and white tablets out of a small plastic cup next to my tray. So, Poe says after he swallowed his last one, since you won't spill, let's talk about me. I'm single, ready to...
You broke up with Michael? I ask, exasperated. Poe!
Poe takes a long sip of his milkshake. Maybe he broke up with me.
Did he?
Yes. Well, it was mutual, he says, before sighing and shaking his head. Whatever, I broke up with him.
I frown. They were perfect for each other. Michael liked skateboarding and had a super popular food blog that Poe had followed religiously for 3 years before they met. He was different from the other people Poe had dated. Older, somehow, even though he had just turned 18. Most importantly, Poe was different with him. You really liked him, Poe. I thought he might be the one. But I should know better. Poe could write a book on commitment issues. Still, that never stopped him on the quest for another great romance. Before Michael, it was Tim. The week after this, it could be David. And to be honest, I envy him a bit with his wild romances. I've never been in love before. Tyler Paul for sure didn't count. But even if I had the chance, dating is a risk that I can't afford right now. I have to stay focused, keep myself alive, get my transplant, reduce parental misery. It's pretty much a full-time job, and definitely not a sexy one.
Well, he's not, Poe says, acting like it's no big deal. Screw him anyway, right?
Hey, at least you got to do that, I say, shrugging as I pick at my eggs. I can see Will's knowing smirk from yesterday when I told him I'd had sex before. Asshole. Poe laughs mid-sip of his milkshake, but he sputters and begins to choke. His vital monitors start beeping on the other side of the laptop as he struggles for breath. Oh my God. No, no, no. I jump up. Poe? I push aside the laptop and run into the hallway as an alarm sounds at the nurse's station, fear in every pore of my body. Somewhere, a voice shouts out,
Room 310, blood oxygen level is in free fall, he's desatting.
Desatting. He can't breathe. He can't breathe. He's choking. Poe's choking, I shout out, tears filling my eyes as I fly down the hallway behind Julie, pulling on a face mask as I go. She bursts through the door ahead of me and goes to check the beeping monitor. I'm scared to look. I'm scared to see Poe suffering. I'm scared to see Poe... Fine. He's fine, sitting in his chair like nothing happened. Relief floods through me, and I break out in a cold sweat as he looks from me to Julie, a sheepish expression on his face as he holds up his fingertip sensor.
Sorry, it came unplugged. I didn't tape it back down after my shower.
I exhale slowly, realizing I've been holding my breath this whole time. which is pretty hard to do when you have lungs that barely work. Julie leans against the wall, looking just as shocked as I am.
Poe! Jeez, when your O2 drops like that...
She shakes her head. Just put it back on.
I don't need it anymore, Jules, he says, looking up at her. Let me take it off.
Absolutely not. Your lung function sucks right now. We've got to keep an eye on you, so you need to keep that damn thing on.
She takes a deep breath, holding out a piece of tape so he can tape the sensor back on.
Please.
He sighs loudly, but reattaches the fingertip sensor to the blood oxygen sensor worn on his wrist.
I nod, finally catching my breath.
I agree, Poe. Keep it on.
He glances up at me as he tapes the sensor onto his middle finger, holding it up to me and grinning. I roll my eyes at him, glancing down the hallway to the asshole's room, 315. The door is tightly closed despite the commotion, a light shining out from under it. He's not even going to poke his head out to make sure everybody's okay. This was practically a floor roll call as everyone opened their door to double check that everything was fine. I fidget and smooth my hair down, looking back over at Poe in time to see him raise his eyebrows at me.
What, you trying to look good for someone?
Don't be ridiculous.
I glare at him and Julie as they shoot curious looks in my direction.
I point at his food. You're about to waste some perfectly good truffles on a bunch of cold eggs, I say, before hurrying off down the hallway to finish our breakfast chat. The more space between room 315 and me, the better.
Chapter 4. Will. I rub my eyes sleepily, clicking on another video, my half-eaten tray of eggs and bacon sitting cold on the table next to me. I've been up all night watching her videos one after the other. It's been a Stella Grant marathon, even with the lame CF content. Scanning the sidebar, I click on the next one. This one's from last year, the lighting ridiculously dark, except for the bright flash of her phone's camera. It looks like a fundraising event, held at a dimly lit bar. There's a huge banner dangling over the stage reading, Save the Planet, Support Earth Day. The camera focuses on a man playing an acoustic guitar, sitting casually on a wooden stool, while a curly brown-haired girl sings. I recognize them both from all the videos I've watched. Stella's dad and her sister Abby. The view spins onto Stella, a big smile on her face, her teeth as white and even as I predicted. She's wearing makeup, and I cough in surprise at how different she looks. It's not the makeup, though. She's happier, calmer. Not like she's been in person. Even the nose cannula looks good on her when she smiles like that. Dad and Abby, stealing the show. If I die before I'm 21, at least I've been in a bar. She swings the camera to show an older woman with the same long brown hair sitting next to her in a bright red booth. Say hi, Mom. The woman waves, giving the camera a big grin. A waitress passes by their table, and Stella waves her down. Yes, I'll take a bourbon, please. Neat. I snort as her mom's voice screams out a, No, she won't. Nice try, Stella, I say, laughing as a bright light comes on, illuminating their faces. The song in the background ends, and Stella begins clapping manically, turning the camera to show her sister, Abby, smiling at her from the stage. So my little sister Stella is here tonight, she says, pointing directly at Stella. As if fighting for her own life isn't enough, she's going to save the planet, too. Come show 'em what you got, Stella. Stella's voice comes through my speakers, confused and shocked. Did you guys plan this? The camera swings back to her mom, who grins. Yep. Go on, baby. I'll film it, her mom says, and everything swings out of focus as Stella hands over the phone. Everyone in the room cheers as she pulls her portable oxygen concentrator onto the stage, her sister, Abby, helping her maneuver up the steps and into the spotlight. She adjusts her cannula nervously as her dad hands her a microphone before she turns to the crowd and speaks. This is a first for me, in front of a crowd anyway. Don't laugh. So, naturally, everyone laughs, including Stella. Only her laugh is filled with nerves. She looks over at her sister warily. Abby says something that her microphone just barely picks up. Bushel and a peck. What does that mean? It works, though, and like magic, the nervousness melts away from Stella's face. Her dad starts to strum away at his guitar, and I hum along before my brain even consciously registers what they're singing. Everyone in the audience is swaying along, too, heads moving left and right, feet tapping with the beat. Now I've heard there was a secret chord. Wow, they can both sing. Her sister is rocking this clear and strong and powerful voice, while Stella's is breathy and soft, smooth in all the right ways. I hit pause as the camera closes in on Stella's face, all her features coming alive in the glow of the spotlight. Carefree and smiling and happy up there on stage next to her sister and her dad. I wonder what made her so uptight yesterday. I run my fingers through my hair, taking in her long hair, the shadow of her collarbone, the way her brown eyes shine when she smiles. Her adrenaline gives her face a twinge of color, her cheeks a bright, exhilarated pink. Not gonna lie, she's pretty. Really pretty. I look away and wait a second. There's no way. I highlight the number with my cursor. 100,000 views? Are you kidding me? Who is this girl? Not even an hour later, my first post-all-nighter nap was interrupted by a blaring alarm down the hall, and then my second attempt was foiled later by my mom and Dr. Hamid bursting into my room for an evening visit. Bored, I stifle a yawn and stare out at the empty courtyard, the cold winds and forecast of snow driving everyone inside. Snow. At least that's something to look forward to. I rest my head against the cool glass, eager for the world outside to be covered in a blanket of white. I haven't touched snow since my first time my mom shipped me off to a top-of-the-line treatment facility to be a guinea pig for an experimental drug to fight B. sepatia. It was in Sweden, and they'd been perfecting this thing for half a decade. Clearly, it wasn't perfected enough, because I was out of there and back home in about 2 weeks flat. At this point, I don't remember much from that particular stay. The only thing I remember from most of my hospital trips is white. White hospital sheets, white walls, white lab coats, all running together. But I do remember the mountains, and the mountains of snow that fell while I was there. The same white, only beautiful, less sterile, real. I'd been dreaming of going skiing in the Alps, lung function be damned. But the only snow I got to touch was on the roof of my mom's Mercedes rental. Will, my mother's voice says, sternly, cutting right through my daydream of fresh powder. Are you listening? Is she kidding? I turn my head to look at her and Dr. Hamid and nod like a bobblehead, even though I haven't heard a single word this entire time. They're going over my first test results since I started the trial a week or so ago, and as usual, nothing's changed. We need to be patient, Dr. Hamid says. The first phase of clinical trials on humans started just 18 months ago. I eye my mother, watching her nod eagerly, her short blonde bob moving up and down at the doctor's words. I wonder how many strings she had to pull and how much money she had to throw away to get me into this. We're monitoring him, but Will needs to help us. He needs to keep the variables in his life at a minimum. Her eyes focus on me, her thin face serious. Will, the risks of cross-infection are even higher now, so I cut her off. Don't cough on any other CFers. Got it. Her black eyebrows jut down as she frowns. Don't get close enough to touch them, for their safety and yours. I hold up my hand in mock pledge, reciting what could probably be the CF motto by this point. 6 feet at all times. She nods. You got it. What I've got is B. sepatia, making this conversation null and void. That's not going to change any time soon. Nothing is impossible, Dr. Hamid says enthusiastically. My mom eats this line up. I believe that. You need to believe it too. I pair an over-the-top smile with a thumbs up before turning it into a thumbs down, shaking my head, the smile slipping off my face. It's such bullshit. Dr. Hamid clears her throat, looking at my mom. Right. I'll leave this to you. Thank you, Dr. Hamid, my mom says, shaking her hand eagerly, like she just managed to sign a contract for her most burdensome client. Dr. Hamid gives me a final, thin-lipped smile before leaving. My mom spins around to look at me, her blue eyes piercing, voice biting. It took a lot of effort to get you into this program, Will. If by effort she means writing a check that could send a small village to college, then she definitely put in quite a bit of effort just so I could be a human petri dish. What do you want? A thank you for shoving me in another hospital, wasting more of my time? I stand up, walking over to face her. In 2 weeks, I'll be 18, a legal adult. You won't hold the reins anymore. For a second, she looks taken aback. Then her eyes narrow at me. She grabs her latest Prada trench coat off the chair by the door, pulling it on and glancing back to look at me. I'll see you on your birthday. I lean out the doorway, watching her go, her heels clicking off down the hallway. She stops at the nurse's station, where Barb is flipping through some papers. Barb, right? Let me give you my cell, I hear her say as she opens her purse, grabbing her wallet from inside. If the sevoflurane doesn't work, Will may become a handful. When Barb doesn't say anything, she pulls a business card out of her wallet. He's been disappointed so many times already, and he's expecting to be disappointed again. If he's not complying, you'll call me. She flicks the business card onto the counter before tossing 100 on top of it, like this is some fancy restaurant and I'm a table that needs to be fawned over. Wow, that's just great. Barb stares at the money, raising her eyebrows at my mother. That was inappropriate, wasn't it? I'm sorry. We've been to so many. Her voice trails off, and I watch as Barb takes the business card and the money off the counter, meeting my mother's gaze with the same look of determination she gives me when she's forcing me to take some medicine. Don't worry. He's in good hands. She presses the 100 back into my mother's hand, pocketing the business card and looking past my mother to meet my eyes. I duck back inside my room, closing the door behind me and tugging at the neck of my T-shirt. I pace over to the window and then back over to sit down on my bed and then back over to the window, pushing back the blinds as the walls start to close in on me. I need to get outside. I need air that's not filled with antiseptic. I throw open my closet door to grab a hoodie, pulling it on and peering out at the nurse's station to see if the coast is clear. No sign of Barb or my mom anymore, but Julie's on the phone behind the desk, in between me and the exit door that will take me straight to the only stairwell in this building that leads to the roof. I close my door quietly, creeping down the hall. I try to duck down lower than the nurse's station, but a 6-foot dude attempting to stay low and sneak around is about as subtle as a blindfolded elephant. Julie looks up at me and I press my back against the wall, pretending to camouflage myself. Her eyes narrow at me as she moves the phone away from her mouth. Where do you think you're going? I mime walking with my fingers. She shakes her head at me, knowing I've been confined to the 3rd floor since I fell asleep by the vending machines over in Building 2 last week and caused a hospital-wide manhunt. I put my hands together, making a pleading motion and hoping the desperation pouring out of my soul will convince her otherwise. At first, nothing. Her face remains firm, her gaze unchanging. Then she rolls her eyes, throwing me a face mask before waving me along to freedom. Thank God. I need to get out of this whitewashed hell more than I need anything. I give her a wink. At least she's actually human. I leave the CF wing, pushing open the heavy door to the stairwell and taking the concrete steps by twos, even though my lungs are burning after just one floor. Coughing, I pull at the metal railing, past the 4th floor and the 5th, and then the 6th, finally coming to a big red door with a huge notice stamped onto it. Emergency exit. Alarm will sound when door is opened. I grab my wallet from my back pocket, taking out a tightly folded dollar bill that I keep in there for moments like these. I reach up and wedge the bill into the frame's alarm switch so the alarm doesn't go off. Then I open the door just a crack and slide through onto the rooftop. Then I bend down to put my wallet in between the door and the jamb so it doesn't slam shut behind me. I've learned that lesson the hard way before. My mom would have a heart attack if she saw I was using the Louis Vuitton wallet she got me a few months ago as a doorstop, but it was a stupid gift to give someone who never goes anywhere but hospital cafeterias. At least as a doorstop, it gets used. I stand up, taking a deep breath and automatically coughing as the cold, harsh winter air shocks my lungs. It feels good, though, to be outside, to not be trapped inside monochrome walls. I stretch, looking up at the pale gray sky, the predicted snowflakes finally drifting slowly through the air and landing on my cheeks and hair. I walk slowly to the roof's edge and take a seat on the icy stone, dangling my legs off the side. I exhale a breath I feel like I've been holding since I got here 2 weeks ago. Everything's beautiful from up here. No matter what hospital I go to, I always make it a point to find a way to get to the roof. I've seen parades from the one in Brazil, the people looking like brightly colored ants as they dance through the streets, wild and free. I've seen France sleep, the Eiffel Tower shining brightly in the distance, lights quietly shutting off in third-floor apartments, the moon drifting lazily into view. I've seen the beaches in California, water that goes on for miles and miles, people basking in the perfect waves first thing in the morning. Every place is different. Every place is unique. It's the hospitals I'm seeing them from that are the same. This town isn't the life of the party, but it feels sort of backroads homey. Maybe that should make me feel more comfortable, but it's only making me more restless. Probably because for the first time in 8 months, I'm a car ride away from home. Home, where Hope and Jason are. Where my old classmates are slowly chugging their way to finals, shooting for whatever Ivy League school their parents selected for them. Where my bedroom, my freaking life, really, sits empty and unlived in. I watch the headlights of the cars driving past on the road next to the hospital, the twinkling holiday lights in the distance, the laughing kids sliding around on the icy pond next to a small park. There's something simple in that, a freedom that makes my fingertips itch. I remember when that used to be me and Jason, sliding around on the icy pond down the street from his house, the cold sinking deep into our bones as we played. We'd be out there for hours, having contests to see who could slide farther without falling, chucking snowballs at each other, making snow angels. We made the most of every minute until my mom inevitably showed up and dragged me back inside. The lights flick on in the hospital courtyard, and I glance down to see a girl sitting inside her room on the third floor, typing away on a laptop, a pair of headphones sitting over top her ears as she concentrates on her screen. Wait a second. I squint. Stella. The cold wind tugs at my hair, and I put my hood up, watching her face as she types. What could she possibly be working on? It's a Saturday night. She was so different in the videos I watched. I wonder what changed. Is it all of this? All of the hospital stuff? The pills and the treatments and those whitewashed walls that push in on you and suffocate you slowly day by day? I stand up, balancing on the edge of the roof, and peer at the courtyard 7 stories down, just for a moment imagining the weightlessness, the absolute abandon of the fall. I see Stella look up through the glass and we make eye contact, just as a strong gust of wind knocks the air right out of me. I try to take a breath to get it back, but my shitty lungs barely take in any oxygen. What air I do get catches in my throat and I start to cough. Hard. My rib cage screams as each cough pulls more and more air from my lungs, my eyes starting to water. Finally, I start to get control of it, but my head swims, the edges of my vision going black. I stumble, freaked out, whipping my head around and trying to focus on the red exit door or the ground or anything. I stare at my hands, willing the black to clear away, the world to come back into view, knowing the open air over the edge of the roof is still barely an inch away.
Chapter 5. Stella. I slam open the door to the stairwell, buttoning my jacket as I book it up the steps to the roof. My heart is pounding so loud in my ears, I can barely hear my footsteps underneath me as I run up the steps. He has to be crazy. I keep picturing him standing there at the edge of the roof, about to plummet 7 stories to his death, fear painted onto every feature of his face, nothing like his previous confident smirk. Wheezing, I make it past the 5th floor, stopping just a moment to catch my breath, my sweaty palms grabbing at the cool metal railing. I peer up the stairwell to the top floor, my head spinning, my sore throat burning. I didn't even have time to grab my portable oxygen. Just 2 more stories. 2 more. I force myself to keep climbing, my feet moving on command. Right, left, right, left, right, left. Finally, the door to the roof is in sight, cracked open under a bright red alarm, just ready to go off. I hesitate, looking from the alarm to the door and back again. But why didn't it go off when Will opened it? Is it broken? Then I see it. A folded dollar bill holding down the switch, stopping the alarm from blaring and letting everyone in the hospital know some crazy guy with cystic fibrosis and self-destructive tendencies is hanging out on the roof. I shake my head. He might be crazy, but that's clever. The door is propped open with a wallet, and I push through it as quickly as I can, making sure the dollar bill stays securely in place over the switch. I stop dead, catching a real breath for the first time in 48 stairs. Looking across the roof, I'm relieved to see he's moved a safe distance away from the edge and hasn't fallen to his death. He turns to look at me as I wheeze, a surprised expression on his face. I pull my red scarf closer as the cold air bites at my face and neck, looking down to see if his wallet is still wedged in the door jamb before storming over to him. "Do you have a death wish?" I shout, stopping a more than safe 8 feet away from him. He may have one, but I certainly don't. His cheeks and nose are red from the cold, and a thin layer of snow has collected on his wavy brown hair and the hood of his burgundy sweatshirt. When he looks like that, I can almost pretend he's not such an idiot. But then he starts talking again. He shrugs at me, casually, motioning over the edge of the roof to the ground below. "My lungs are toast, so I'm going to enjoy the view while I can." How poetic. Why did I expect anything different? I peer past him to see the twinkling city skyline far, far in the distance, the holiday lights covering every inch of every tree, brighter now than I've ever seen them as they bring the park below back to life. Some are even strung across the trees, creating this magical pathway you could walk under, head back, mouth agape. In all my years here, I've never been on the roof. Shivering, I pull my jacket tighter, wrapping my arms around my body as I move my eyes back to him. "Good view or not, why would anyone want to risk falling 7 stories? I ask him, genuinely wondering what would possess someone with defective lungs to take a trip onto the roof in the dead of winter. His blue eyes light up in a way that makes my stomach flip-flop. "You ever see Paris from a roof, Stella? Or Rome? Or here, even? It's the only thing that makes all this treatment crap seem small."
"Treatment crap?" I ask, taking 2 steps toward him. 6 feet apart, the limit. "That treatment crap is what keeps us alive." He snorts, rolling his eyes.
"That treatment crap is what stops us from being down there and actually living."
My blood begins to boil. "Do you even know how lucky you are to be in this drug trial? But you just take it for granted, a spoiled, privileged brat."
"Wait, how do you know about the trial? You've been asking about me?"
I ignore his questions, pushing on. "If you don't care, then leave," I fire back. "Let someone else take your spot in the trial. Someone who wants to live." I look up at him, watching as the snow falls in the space between us, disappearing as it lands in the dusting under our feet. We stare at each other in silence, and then he shrugs, his expression unreadable. He takes a step backward toward the edge again.
"You're right. I mean, I'm dying anyway."
I narrow my eyes at him. He wouldn't. "Right?" Another step back. And another, his footsteps crunching in the freshly fallen snow.
His eyes are locked on mine, daring me to say something, to stop him, challenging me to call out to him. Closer, almost to the edge. I inhale sharply, the cold scraping at the inside of my lungs. He dangles one foot off the end, and the open air makes my throat tighten up. He can't. Will! No! Stop! I shout, taking a step closer to him, my heart pounding in my ears. He stops, leg floating off the edge. One more step, and he would have fallen. One more step, and he would have... We stare at each other in silence, his blue eyes curious, interested. And then he starts to laugh, loud and deep and wild, in a way so familiar it feels like pressing on a bruise. Oh my God, the look on your face was priceless. He mimics my voice. Will, no, stop. Are you fucking kidding me? Why would you do that? Falling to your death isn't a joke. I can feel my whole body shaking. I dig my fingernails into my palm, trying to stop the trembling as I turn away from him. Oh, come on, Stella, he calls after me. I was only fooling around. I pull open the rooftop door and step over the wallet, wanting to put as much space as possible between us. Why did I even bother? Why did I climb 4 stories to see if he was okay? I start running down the first few steps, reaching up to realize I forgot to put on my face mask. I never forget my face mask. I slow down and then stop completely as an idea pops into my head. Climbing back up to the door, I slowly pull the dollar bill off the alarm switch, pocketing it as I fly back down to the 3rd floor of the hospital. Leaning against the brick wall, I catch my breath before pulling off my jacket and scarf, opening the door and strolling to my room, as if I've just been off at the NICU. Somewhere in the distance, the roof alarm goes off as Will opens the door to get back inside, distant but blaring as it echoes down the stairwell, reverberating in the hallway. I can't help but smile. Julie tosses a blue patient folder onto the desk behind the nurse's station, shaking her head and murmuring to herself, "The roof, Will. Really. Good to know I'm not the only one he's driving crazy." I gaze out the window, watching the snow fall and the fluorescent glow of the courtyard lights, the hallway finally dead silent after Will's hour-long reprimanding. Glancing over at the clock, I see it's only 8 p.m., which gives me plenty of time to work on number 14 on my to-do list, prepare app for beta testing, and number 15, complete dosage table for diabetes before I go to bed tonight. I check my Facebook quickly before getting started, a red notification for an invite to a senior trip beach blast this Friday night in Cabo popping up. I click on the page and see that they use the description I'd drafted back when I was still organizing this, and I'm not sure if that makes me feel better or worse. I scroll through the list of people going, seeing Camila's and Maya's pictures and Mason's, now sans Brooke, followed by pictures of a half dozen other people from my school who have already replied with a yes. My iPad begins to ring, and I see a FaceTime call coming in from Camila. It's like they knew I was thinking about them. I smile and swipe right to accept the call, almost getting blinded when the bright sunshine of whatever pristine beach they're sitting on bursts through the screen of my iPad. "Okay, I'm officially jealous," I say, as Camila's sunburnt face comes into view. Maya lunges to stick her face over Camila's shoulder, her curly hair bouncing into the frame. She's wearing the polka dot one piece I helped her pick out, but she clearly doesn't have time for pleasantries.
Are there any cute guys there? And don't you dare say, just Poe, we say at the same time.
Camila shrugs, fixing her glasses.
Poe counts. He is cute.
Maya snorts, nudging Camila.
Poe is 1,000% not interested in you, Camila.
Camila punches her playfully in the arm and then freezes, squinting at me.
Oh my God. Is there? Stella, is there a cute guy there?
I roll my eyes.
He is not cute. He?
The two of them squeal in delight, and I can sense the waterfall of questions that's about to pour over me.
I gotta go. Talk to you tomorrow,
I say while they protest and hang up. The moment on the roof is still a little too fresh and weird to talk about. The page for the Cabo beach party swings back into view. I hover over not going, but I can't bring myself to click on it just yet, so instead I just close the page and pull up Visual Studio. I open the project I've been working on and begin to sort through the lines and lines of code, already feeling my muscles loosen as I do. I find an error in line 27, where I put a C instead of an X for a variable, and a missing equal sign in line 182. But aside from that, the app finally looks ready to go for beta. I almost can't believe it. I'll celebrate with a pudding cup later. I try to move on to completing the dosage table for diabetes in my spreadsheet of the most prevalent chronic conditions, sorting through varying ages and weights and medications. But I soon find myself staring at the blank columns, my fingertips tapping away at the edge of my laptop instead, my mind a million miles away. Focus. I reach over to grab my pocket notebook, crossing off number 14 and trying to get the feeling of calm that usually comes from finishing to-do list items. But it doesn't come. I freeze as my pencil hovers over number 15, looking from the blank columns and rows on my spreadsheet back down to complete dosage table for diabetes. Unfinished. Ugh. I chuck the notebook onto my bed, restlessness and unease filling my stomach. Standing up, I walk over to the window, my hand pushing back the blinds. My eyes travel to the roof, to the spot where Will was standing earlier. I know he was his usual self when I got up there, but I didn't imagine the coughing and teetering, or the fear. Mr. Death comes for us all, didn't want to die. Restless, I walk over to my med cart, hoping that moving on to before-bed meds on my to-do list will help calm me down. My fingers tap away on the metal of the cart as I look at the sea of bottles and then out the window again at the roof, and then back at the bottles. Is he even doing his treatments? Barb can probably force him to take most of his meds, but she can't be there for every single dose. She can strap him into his Aflo vest, but she can't ensure he keeps it on for the full half hour. He's probably not doing all his treatments. I try to go over the meds in order of when I take them, shuffling them around on the cart, the names all blurring together. Instead of feeling calm, I feel more and more frustration, the anger climbing up the sides of my head. I struggle with the cap on a mucus thinner, pressing down on it with all my strength and trying to twist it off. I don't want him to die. The thought climbs on top of the mountain of frustration and plants a flag, clear and loud and so surprising to me that I don't even understand it. I just see him walking back to the edge of that roof. And even though he's the actual worst, I don't want him to die. I twist the lid sharply and it comes flying off, pills showering down onto my med cart. Angrily, I slam the bottle down, the pills jumping again with the force of my hand. Damn it!
Chapter 6. Will. I open the door to my room, surprised to see Stella backing up against the wall on the other side of the hallway. After the stunt I pulled yesterday, I thought she'd steer clear of me for at least a week. She's wearing about 4 face masks and 2 pairs of gloves, her fingers wrapped tightly around the plastic handrail on the wall. As she moves, I catch the scent of lavender. It smells nice. It's probably my nose craving anything that isn't bleach. I grin. Are you my proctologist? She gives me what I think is an icy look from what I can see of her face, leaning to peer past me into my room. I glance behind me to see what she's looking at. The art books, the AFLA vest hanging on the edge of the bed from when I shrugged it off as soon as Barb left, my open sketchbook on the table. That's about it. I knew it, she says finally, like she confirmed the answer to some great Sherlock Holmes mystery. She holds out her double-gloved hand. Let me see your regimen. You're kidding, right? We stare each other down, her brown eyes shooting daggers through me while I try to give her an equally intimidating glare. But I'm bored as shit, so my curiosity gets the better of me. I roll my eyes and turn to rip apart my room, looking for a sheet of paper that's probably already in a landfill somewhere. I push aside some magazines and check under the bed. I riffle through a couple of my sketchbook pages and even look under my pillow for show, but it's nowhere to be found. I straighten up and shake my head at her. Can't find it. Sorry. See you later. She doesn't budge, though, and crosses her arms in defiance, refusing to leave. So I keep looking, my eyes scanning the room while Stella taps her foot in the hallway impatiently. It's useless. That thing is... Wait. I notice my pocket-sized sketchbook lying on my dresser, the regimen crammed into the back of it, neatly folded and just barely sticking out past the small pages of the book. My mom must have hidden it in there so it didn't end up in the garbage bin. I grab it, heading back to the doorway, and hold out the paper to her. Not that it's any of your business. She snatches the paper from me before pressing back up against the far wall. I see her furiously looking at the neat columns and rows that I made into a pretty sick cartoon, imitating a level of Donkey Kong, while Mom and Dr. Hamid chatted. The latter sit on top of my dosage information, rolling barrels bounce around my treatment names. The damsel in distress screams help in the left-hand corner next to my name. Clever, right? What is... How could you... Why... Clearly, she doesn't think so. Is this what an aneurysm looks like? Should I call Julie? She shoves the paper back at me, her face like thunder. Hey, I say, holding up my hands. I get that you have some save-the-world hero complex going on, but leave me out of it. She shakes her head at me. Will, these treatments aren't optional. These meds aren't optional. Which is probably why they keep shoving them down my throat. To be fair, though, anything can be optional if you're creative enough. Stella shakes her head, throwing up her hands and storming off down the hallway. You're making me crazy! Dr. Hamid's words from earlier surprise me by playing through my head. Don't get close enough to touch them, for their safety and yours. I grab a face mask from an unopened box of them that Julie put by my door, pocket it, and jog after her. I glance to the side to see a short, brown-haired boy with a sharp nose and even sharper cheekbones staring out of room 310, his eyebrows raised curiously at me as I follow Stella down the hall to the elevator. She reaches the elevator first, stepping inside and turning to face me as she hits the floor button. I move to step in after her, but she holds up her hand. 6 feet. Shit. The doors slide shut and I tap my foot impatiently, pressing the up button over and over and over again as I watch the elevator climb steadily up to the 5th floor and then slowly back down to me. I glance nervously at the empty nurse's station behind me before sliding quickly into the elevator and jamming the door close button. I meet my own gaze in the blurry metal of the elevator, remembering the face mask in my pocket and slinging it on as I ride up to the 5th floor. This is stupid. Why am I even following Barb Jr.? With a ding, the door slowly opens and I power walk down the hall and across the bridge to the east entrance of the NICU, dodging a few doctors along the way. They're all clearly on their way somewhere, so no one stops me. Gently pushing open the door, I watched Stella for a moment. I open my mouth to ask what the hell that was all about, but then I see her expression is dark. Serious. I stop a safe distance away from her and follow her eyes to the baby, more tubes and wires than limbs. I see the tiny chest, struggling to rise and fall, struggling to continue breathing. I feel my own heartbeat in my chest, my own weak lungs trying to fill with air from my mad dash through the hospital. She's fighting for her life, she finally says, meeting my eyes in the glass. She doesn't know what's ahead of her or why she's fighting. It's just instinct, Will. Her instinct is to fight, to live. Instinct. I lost that instinct a long time ago. Maybe at my 50th hospital in Berlin. Maybe about 8 months ago, when I contracted B. sepatia and they ripped my name off the transplant list. There are a lot of possibilities. My jaw tightens. Listen, you've got the wrong guy for that inspiring little speech. Please? She cuts me off, spinning around to face me with a surprising amount of desperation in her expression. I need you to follow your regimen, strictly and completely. I don't think I heard that right. Did you just say, please? I say, trying to dodge the seriousness of this conversation. Her expression doesn't change, though. I shake my head, stepping closer to her, but not too close. Something's up. Okay, what's really going on here? I won't laugh. She takes a deep breath, taking 2 steps back to my 1 step forward. I have control issues. I need to know that things are in order. So, what does that have to do with me? I know you're not doing your treatments. She leans against the glass, looking at me. And it's messing me up. Bad. I clear my throat, looking past her at the small, helpless baby on the other side of the glass. I feel a twinge of guilt, even though that makes no sense. Yeah, well, I'd love to help you out, but what you're asking... I shake my head, shrugging. I don't know how. Bullshit, Will, she says, stomping her foot. All CFers know how to administer their own treatments. We're practically doctors by the time we're 12. Even us spoiled, privileged brats? I challenge, ripping the face mask off. She isn't amused by my comment, and her face is still frustrated, distressed. I don't know what the real problem is, but it's clearly eating away at her. This is more than control issues. Taking a deep breath, I stop screwing around. You're serious? I'm messing you up? She doesn't respond, and we stand there, staring at each other in silence, something bordering on understanding passing between us. Finally, I take a step back and put on the face mask again as a peace offering, before leaning against the wall. Okay, all right, I say, eyeing her. So if I agree to this, what's in it for me? Her eyes narrow as she pulls her heather gray hoodie closer to her. I watch her, the way her hair falls over her shoulders, the way her eyes show every little thing she's feeling. I want to draw you, I say before I can stop myself. What? She says, shaking her head adamantly. No. Why not? I ask. You're beautiful. Shit, that slipped out. She stares at me, surprised, and, unless I'm imagining it, just a little pleased. Thank you, but no way. I shrug and start walking toward the door. Guess we don't have a deal. You can't practice a little discipline, stick to your regimen, even to save your own life? I stop short, looking back at her. She doesn't get it. Nothing's gonna save my life, Stella, or yours. I keep going down the hallway, calling over my shoulder. Everyone in this world is breathing borrowed air. I push the door open, and I'm about to leave when her voice rings out from behind me. Ah, fine. I spin around, shocked, the door clicking shut. But no nudes, she adds. She's taken her face mask off, and I can see her lips twitching into a smile, the first one she's given me. She's making a joke. Stella Grant is making a joke. I laugh, shaking my head. I should have known you'd find a way to suck all the fun out of it. No posing for hours on end, she says, looking back at the preemie, her face suddenly serious. and your regimen. We do it my way. Deal, I say, knowing that whatever she means by her way is going to be a gigantic pain in the ass. I'd say let's shake on it, but... Funny, she says, looking at